And welcome to the Accessibility Online Webinar Series. Today's session is a collaboration between the ADA National Network and the U.S. Access Board. For those following on the telephone, chat area is not available for those on telephone, obviously, so please send your emails with questions to webinars@ada-audio.org. For those in the room, if you are having audio and video problems, as I mentioned earlier, you can correct that by accessing the audio and video bar icon by sliding the bar that has little speaker lines in the audio and video panel of the webinar platform. You can move that bar left and right, and it will increase your sound to your preference. You can also access the audio setup wizard by going to the tools menu and selecting audio setup wizard, or you can click on the little microphone icon with the little star there, and that will take you directly to the audio setup wizard as well. For those, as I mentioned, on the telephone, we have a new email address that you can send your questions to, so I just want to make sure that that was captured in the announcements that were sent out. That email address is webinars@ada-audio.org. And for those in the webinar platform, if you do continue to have problems with your audio and prefer, you can switch to the cell phone. And that number is displayed on the current slide, which is 712-432-3100. Passcode is 930098. We also have a mobile app available for this session. You would have to go to the iTunes store and download the mobile app. Just note for those on the mobile app listening, you chats will be made public. There is no private chats on that feature. As well as closed captioning is not available, so if you need those, mobile app is not the option for you. You will have to connect to the desktop. Real-time captioning is also available, as I mentioned. You can find that also in the audio and video box. There's a little CC icon found there. You can click on that. It will open a box with the closed captioning. That box can be moved around, stretched, and shrink as you please, and also adjust your background color and font size. In the chat area, for submitting a question, those that are using keyboard navigation to get focus into the keyboard, into the chat area, we use your keyboard. That is keyboard stroke control M, and this way you will have your cursor focused in the chat area. You can submit your questions to the presenters. Again, those on the telephone, you would have to do it via email at webinars@ada-audio.org. The webinar platform also allows you to increase your size of the PowerPoint as you prefer. Above the PowerPoint presentation, there is a drop-down box that says Fit Page, and it'll give you percentage options there. You can pick the one that suits your needs best. You can resize or reposition the chat area by detaching that chat area. If you go to the audio video panel, There's a little
Thanks, Claudia,
icon
and welcome everyone to our session on
area.
Accessible elevators and platform lifts.
Click on that drop down.
With this session, you'll not only hear from the access
board,
but you're also going to hear from an expert in accessible elevators and elevator
problems
codes.
With the
As you know,
platform,
this is an area in the standards where we reference another standard for compliance. In this case,
as your host, and I'll try to work
those
out with you. Or you can email webinars at ed-audio.org. We'll call our center
so,
877-232-1990.
Introducing Jim Peck, who is going to be
at this time,
our first presenter. And,
introduce Peggy
Greenwald
of the
Jim
U.S. Access Board. She will be your moderator for today's session.
Joined the Access Board in November of 1991, so he's been here quite a while, and has a degree in architecture, master's in architecture from the University of Maryland. He's also a member of the National Fire Protection Association and an associate member of the AIA. He's been very involved in the guideline development or the basis for the 2010 standard, and as you know, is a regular presenter in this webinar series. We also have with us today, we're fortunate to have with us today, Brian Black. Brian is the president of the B.D. Black and Associates, and has been a code and safety consultant for the national elevator industry since 2007. He's a member of the ASME A17 Safety Code for Elevators and Escalator Standards, Hoistway, Emergency Operations, Outdoor Evacuation Elevators, and Code Coordination Committees, and the ASME Qualification of Elevator Inspectors Committee. Brian has worked in the accessibility, worked for over 30 years in the field of accessibility for persons with disabilities, including serving as a director of building codes and standards for the Eastern Paralyzed Veterans Association. He also served on one of our federal advisory committees, the ADAG Advisory Committee, when we were updating the 1991 standard and what became the 2004 ADA ABA. He's a member of the International Code Council and National Fire Protection Association
and
the American Society of Civil Engineers. So
as Peggy said, we're
without
going to be
further hesitation,
about
I'm going to turn it over to Jim to start us off for today's session.
That are covered by the ADA and the Architectural Barriers Act standards. And we're going to be going into some scoping provisions and technical provisions and all that kind of good stuff. So slide 13. What we're going to be talking about today is scoping, where a vertical axis is required by the standard. Then I'm going to be talking more in detail about some of the technical provisions of elevators and platform lifts. And then at that point, I'll be turning it over to Brian, who will be talking about who the American Society of Mechanical Engineers actually is and what they do, and give you a little background on that, on those folks. He's then going to talk briefly about elevators, some myths and some facts that are floating around out there, and try to straighten some of those out. And then we'll be talking briefly again on about the American Society of Mechanical Engineers A17.1, which is the elevator safety code, and the A18, which is the platform lift code, and then very briefly about what's in the future for elevators. Slide 14. So let's start off with where vertical access is required in buildings and facilities under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Architectural Barriers Act. Slide 15. As you know, the standards are basically a new construction or an alteration requirement for buildings and facilities as far as accessibility is concerned. In new construction, vertical access between floors is required in most multi-story buildings. There are some exceptions, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But for the most part, full-blown passenger elevators are usually what's provided to provide vertical access between stories and to mezzanines. Slide 16. Basically, when you provide an elevator, it has to meet the requirements, and each elevator provided, whether it's required or not, has to comply with the standard. So you could have a building that's not required to have an elevator, but nonetheless you want to provide one, it will still be required to comply with all the provisions of the standards for new construction. There are other types of elevators, which in addition to a full passenger elevator, one is called a limited use, limited application elevator, or LULA. Those are permitted in facilities not required to have an accessible route between stories or to mezzanines. So if you have a building that's not required to have an elevator, but nonetheless want to put vertical access in, a LULA is a good way to do that because it is a less expensive and not quite as complex piece of machinery as a full-blown passenger elevators. LULAs can also be used as alternatives to platform lifts where they're permitted and private residence elevators. We had a question that came in early, and basically it says, I have searched without success for any indication of when and where a limited use limited application elevator is permitted to comply with an accessible route requirements. And basically I'm going to try to talk about that and as we go along. And like I say, for the most part, it's where a full passenger elevator is not required. And that in those areas, you're allowed to use a limited use, limited application area elevator. Slide 17. So, there is an exception to the requirement for vertical access in buildings. It applies to private buildings. These are buildings that are covered under Title III of the ADA, commercial facilities and places of public accommodation, and that are less than three stories or have less than 3,000 square feet per story unless the building or facility is, and there's a whole list of things that the Department of Justice has said that you cannot use the elevator exception for. They are shopping centers, shopping malls, and they are defined fairly tightly in the Justice Department's regulation. The professional office of a healthcare provider, a terminal, depot, or other station used for specified public transit, or an airport passenger terminal, or any other type of facility as determined by the Attorney General. Again, this is for private buildings, and you'll notice that I said or. The exception applies to anything that's two stories, no matter what size it is, or it could be multi-story. It could be a four or five story walk-up, but each floor has to be 2,000 square feet or less. In other words, you could not have a three-story building that had two upper floors that were 3,000 square feet or less, but the bottom floor was, let's say, 4,000 square feet. That building would be required to have an elevator under the Justice Department's regulations. Slide 18. Now, again, like I said, this exception for under three stories or 3,000 square feet or less only applies to privately owned commercial facilities and places of public accommodation under the Title III regulation, which is the Justice Department's 28 Code of Federal Regulation, Part 36. You cannot use this exception if it's a federal, state, or local government facility. Those facilities are required to have vertical access in two or more stories, and no matter what the square footage is. If it's a federal, state, or local facility, and it's a multi-story building, over one story, it's required to have an elevator in it. Now, there is a new exception that was added when we did the revision to the guidelines for federal, state, and local facilities. It's basically for very small spaces, which has only one story with an occupant load of 5 people or less, and is not open to the general public, not open to the public. So this is basically an employee-only position or area. An example of that would be like a state drawbridge tower that sits along a drawbridge. It's basically where the guy goes up and, you know, actually activates the drawbridge and lets that go. So it's usually a very small space, limited to very small people and only not open to the public. That can be found at section 206.2.3, exception 2 in the ADA guidelines, and F206.2.3, exception 1 in the Federal Architectural Barriers Act standards. Slide 19. Platform lifts in section 206.7 and F206.7 are very limited in their use in new construction. It's only in a few places that you're actually allowed to use a platform lift in new construction. These are for performance areas like a stage. Incidental, small, non-public spaces, again, these are spaces that are, you know, very small occupancy, not open to the general public. Judicial spaces such as jury boxes and witness stands, they have different requirements and are allowed to use a platform lift. Where existing site constraints make them the only option, in other words, for some reason, the topography or something will not let you use a ramp or a full-blown passenger elevator. You're also allowed to use them in guest rooms and residential dwelling units. Now, when I say guest rooms and residential dwelling units, I don't mean a full transient lodging facility or a full residential facility. I'm talking about the unit itself. In other words, the guest room is 2 stories, or the dwelling unit is 2 or more stories. That in those conditions, you're allowed to use a platform lift. You're also allowed to use a platform lift to get access to amusement rides and to certain areas in play areas for kids. Another one is team player seating. In other words, this is where you know the dugout at the baseball game or the bench that's in front of the ice and the hockey team for the hockey team. You're allowed to use a platform lift to get to those seating areas. And the last is you're allowed to use a platform lift to get to recreational boating facilities or fishing piers and platforms where you have, you know, a rather large change in topography to get down to the water, basically, is what you're talking about here. Slide 20. Platform lifts, as far as existing buildings, are always permitted. You're always permitted to use a platform lift as in an existing building. In other words, either as part of an alteration or just because you want to provide access to an existing building, let's say a historic building, where you really don't want to do a whole lot of alteration work, but you can bring in and place a platform lift or an incline platform lift that would go up a set of stairs, and we'll talk about when you can use those in a little bit later. Slide 21. So this is a sort of a brief when and where kind of table, if you will. It's basically gives you a facility space, and then it gives you the elevator type that's permitted to be used. The first is obviously f- facilities required to provide accessible room between stories and two mezzanines. That requires a full passenger elevator, meeting section 407 of the standards. Excuse me. Facilities not required to provide an accessible route that can use lot as the exception to stories or mezzanines are allowed to use either a standard passenger elevator, section 407, or they can use a limited use, limited application elevator. This is one of the areas where you can use a LULA, and they're in section 408 is the technical requirements for those devices. In residential dwelling units, like I said before, again, and also this would include guest rooms as well, you're allowed to use this. You can put a standard full-blown passenger elevator, or you can use a LULA, limited use, limited application elevator. Or in residential dwelling units, and only residential dwelling units, you're allowed to use a private residence elevator, and those can be found in section 409 for technical requirements. And the last are the spaces that can be served by a platform lift, that lift I gave you, or in an alteration. In that case, you're allowed to use either full standard elevator or limited use, limited application elevator as well. Slide 22. So that's basically where elevators are required, where vertical access is required, and where you can provide it with an elevator or a platform lift very briefly. So now we're going to talk about the technical provisions and some of the differences in between the old standard and the new standard as we go along. Slide 23. As Peggy said, part of the standard is now what we call a reference standard. Actually, we've always had a reference to the elevator safety code. That goes back to the old UFAS standard years and years ago, referenced as a very old ASME 817 code. And the new standard does the same thing, except it also references the ASME A17.1. That's a typo there. That should be A171. That should be A17.1. The 1999 and 2000 edition of the elevator safety code for both or for all full-blown passenger elevators, limited use, limited application elevators, and private residence elevators. Those are all covered and specified in the 1990 and 2000 edition of the safety code. And what's new is we now reference a new standard, which sort of used to be a provision of the A17, but broke off and became its own code, the ASME A18, which is the safety standard for platform lifts and stairway lifts. So section 410.1 references the standard for those devices, and that's now a reference standard as well. So what do we mean by a reference standard? That means that we say that everything in those standards you now have to comply with to meet the ADA and ABA standards. This is basically now part of the standard and is used as such. Slide 24. So let's get into passenger elevators. The elevator landing requirements at section 407.2 give you a bunch of information about what the outside or the hall area that where the entrance to the elevator is. You have to have a hall call light, which tells you which way the elevator is going, either up or down. That has to be at 72 inches minimum above the floor to the center line of that light. On the jamb of the elevator door, you have to have raised braille and floor designations, raised characters and braille floor designations. either a G or a C or a 1 or whatever with the braced braille, and it has to be on both jams. Also in the hall is the call buttons. They are basically required to be within the reach range specified in section 308 of the standard, again, to the center line of the buttons. And you also are required to have, you know, since it's a control and operating mechanism, basically, you have to have clear floor space complying with 305 in front of that so that you can reach it either for a forward or a parallel approach. Either is allowed. Slide 25. So car control, section 407.2.1, this is basically the buttons you push to call the elevator. They have to be compliant as an operable part, like I said before, complying with section 308 and meaning in the reach ranges, and 309, which is the operable part section. The up button must be above the down button so it's easy for somebody to figure out which is which. There has to be a visual indication that the call is registered and the call is answered. So usually you punch the button and the light in the button goes on saying the call is there. And when the elevator shows up, the light goes out, which means it's been answered. The buttons themselves have to be raised or flush, either with the face of the plate that they're sitting on, or if you're providing some sort of trim, ring, or ferrule, that has to be flush with that. You cannot have recessed buttons. They're difficult for many people with disabilities who have gripping and pushing issues to deal with. Slide 27. Excuse me, slide 26. I apologize. Now, this is the hall signals. These are the lights above the elevator door. Again, they're like 72 inches above the floor. They're required at each hoistway, including elevators with only two stops. They indicate the car arrival and the travel direction, either whether the car is going up or down. There's a visual indicator that has to be vertical, or it can be side by side. You can put them next to each other. It has to be visible from the area of the hall call button, including those that are placed in cars. Sometimes they're put it on the inside edge of the car on the jam, but they have to be visible from somebody who's standing in front of the button. In other words, if you push the button, you have to be able to see them from wherever you made the call for the elevator from. They're also required to have an audible signal, one up, one tone up for down, one tone for up and two tones for going down. It can be a beep or a tone or anything you want. Or you can have a verbal enunciator that gives you, a verbal description of whether it's going up or down. The frequency is 1500 hertz, which is a maximum. Or if it's a verbal enunciator, it can be between 300 and 3,000 hertz. And the signal level, which is the sound level, if you will, is 10 dB or decibels above, minimum above ambient, and 80 dB max. Slide 27. The hoistway signs, again, these are the ones on the jams. They're on both jams of the elevator door, on each elevator door. They have to be between 48 and 60 inches above the finished floor. That's measured to the raised character baseline. In other words, the bottom of the character has to be between 48 inches and 60 inches. This is a change. It used to be 60 inches absolute. This is a change that sort of reflects the changes that were made in the signage requirements of the standard. And so it was allowed to be within this range. The characters have to be sans serif, in other words, without little G-holes or corners or curly Qs or whatever. And they have to be raised at least a 32nd of an inch. They're also required to meet the character proportion and stroke thickness. In other words, the thickness of the actual piece of the letter has to be a certain requirement, and it's similar to those that are required by the signage requirements. On the main entry level, you're required to have a tactile star, which tells you this is the main entry level and the main exit level, usually an emergency, the kind of thing you want to get off at that level. The raised floor designation, the character has to be a minimum of 2 inches high, and there has to be a minimum of 3/8 of an inch spacing between either a character and the braille beneath it, which is grade 2, by the way, or 3/8 of an inch between the braille and any raised border or edge of that that hoistway sign. Slide 28. Elevated door requirements in section 407.3. Elevated doors are required to be a minimum of 36 inch minimum clear width. This is different from a standard swing door in an office or something like that. And we'll talk about that in a minute, as why they're required to be at least 36 inches minimum. There are certain types of elevators which have a different configuration. They're required to be 42 inches minimum. If the car is 80 inches by 51 inches, and we can talk about those spaces in a little bit. The doors have to be horizontal sliding doors. You can't have vertical doors like the old freight elevators used to have. And they have to be automatic, and they have to be sliding horizontally. And they have to remain open for at least 3 seconds. Also, there has to be reopening devices that have detection points at least 5 inches and 29 inches. Now, most elevators today have a strip that runs the full height of the door that has detection in it. So it detects anything that becomes into the door and will reopen the door, and it will close on somebody. And so the 5 and the 29 are kind of a throwback to an older era, if you will. Slide 29. Door timing in section 407.3.4. This is basically the time that an elevated door has to remain open from when it answers a call to when the doors start to close. Again, it's a specific timing calculation, and it's basically you go to the call button that's controlling that car, or the farthest one that's away from that car, and you measure out from the wall from that button 60 inches. And from that point, you measure a diagonal to the center line of the hoistway opening at the hoistway door. And that is an element or number, which is D in calculated in feet. You then calculate the minimum timing mean in seconds with D divided by 1.5 feet per second, and it comes out to it has to be a minimum of at least 5 seconds. So, and I think Brian's going to talk a little bit more about this in his section. slide 30. Minimum car dimensions, 407.4.1. The two figures that are shown here are the original minimum requirements from the 1991 standard, where you have a center door, 42 inches minimum clear opening, and it's 51 inches minimum deep and 80 inches minimum wide, or you have a side opening door that's 36 minimum inches open, which is 51 inches deep and 68 minimum inches minimum wide. You'll notice that neither of these two elevators are able to use a 5 foot turning space. And I think Brian's going to talk a little bit about that, so I'll leave that to his part. But basically what's going to happen is these two elevators utilize a T-turn, which actually puts one of the legs of the T's outside in the elevator lobby or through the door. Slide 31. In the new document, we added some other car configurations to show that these were acceptable, because people were seeing those minimum configurations and thinking, well, depending on my configuration, whether it's wide this way and narrow this way, they didn't think their configurations met the minimum requirements. We wanted to make it clear that if you have a car that's 54 inches by 80 inches, which is your standard hospital elevator car, that was acceptable. Or if you had a car that was 60 inches by 60 inches inside and allowed you to have a 5 foot turning space, that was acceptable as well. So these two car configurations are allowed and specifically specified in the table in the standard. Slide 32. Elevated car controls in section 407.4.6 and 7. Basically, inside the car, you have a panel of elevator buttons, and the columns are to be read from right to left. In other words, you start on the right, and are to be read from left to right. Excuse me, I apologize for that. You start on the left and you read over to the right as far as the numbers go, one on the right, two on the left, two, I'm getting it backwards again, I'm sorry. One on the left, two on the right, three on the left, four on the right, etc. The numbers are to be in ascending order. They start from the highest and go down to the lowest. The maximum height for any button, any operable part, on that panel is 48 inches, or it can be 54 inches if the car serves over 16 floors and you provide a parallel approach to the panel, which would allow a slightly higher reach for some folks in mobility aids. The emergency controls, the alarm button, etc., are grouped at the bottom of the panel, along with the door open and close buttons. The emergency controls are required to be at a center line of 35 inches minimum above the floor of the car. Slide 33. And this is a close-up of the top part of a car control panel. Again, you have, next to the button that you press for the floor you want, you have a raised character to the left of the button. It's raised a 32nd of an inch and it's sans serif. In other words, no little curly cues or anything like that. The character has to be between 5/8 of an inch and 2 inches high. Next to that or below it, you are required to provide grade 2 braille, which is also raised, obviously, and with a minimum separation from either the character or any other raised element of 3/16 of an inch minimum. The buttons themselves are required to be 3/4 of an inch minimum in their smallest dimension. They can be, again, raised or flush. They cannot be indented or otherwise recessed. And you're also required to have a visible signal of the car, registered a car, when you want to, the button the floor you want. In other words, you press the button lights or some other visual signal goes on. And when you the car reaches that floor, it goes out. So slide 34. This is a picture of the bottom half of the control panel, again, 407.4.7. Again, the main entry floor, which in this case is signified by a numeral 1, has to have a tactile star next to it. Again, there needs to be 3/16 of an inch between the characters and the braille underneath it to describe that character. Now, we don't specify that you have to have all numbers. You know, the ground floor could be specified with a G. The parking levels could be specified with a P1, P2. There are also places that use M for mezzanines and other things. And sometimes it gets a bit confusing. We sort of recommend that, if at all possible, to use numbers to make it a little bit easier to understand for most people. But that's not a requirement. Again, you can have Braille either underneath the character or to the to one side of it. The other controls that are down here is the door open, which is the two triangles pointing outward, or the door closed, which are two triangles pointing inward. There is an emergency controls that are grouped at the bottom, which is an alarm, which is given with a bell. And then there is, again, another holdover from an old era, which is the emergency stop button, which is, I think Brian's going to tell you that these are no longer allowed by the ASME committee. But anyway, I'll let him talk about that a little bit more. So, slide 35. So let me talk a little bit about alterations to existing elevators and those kind of things. If you alter an elevator, it's an alteration just like any other alteration, and the alteration has to comply with the standard, whatever part of the elevator you're altering, to the maximum extent feasible. In other words, if it's technically feasible to do the alteration in compliance with the standard, you do that. If it's not, then you do it to the maximum extent feasible. That's just like any other alteration that you're doing. The standards apply to those elements that are being altered. In other words, if you only alter the panel, that's what the scope of the work of the alteration is. That's what you apply the standard to. You don't have to then go do something else in the elevator because that's not part of the scope of work. An important thing is, if you make an alteration to one car, you have to make the same alteration to every elevator that's programmed to respond to that same whole call button. In other words, if you've got a bank of four elevators and you change the panel in one, you have to change it in all four so that all four will be the same, because you don't want one that's more accessible than the other and have somebody try to figure out which elevator I have to wait for so I can use it. So next is 36. And I need to speed up a little bit. Limited use, limited application elevators. Again, like I said before, these are permitted in facilities where the accessible route between the stories or the mezzanine is not required. or where you are allowed to use a private residence elevator or platform lift. What you can't use a limited use limited application elevator for is any place where a standard passenger elevator is required. You cannot substitute a LULA for a standard passenger elevator. Slide 37. LULAs have to comply with the requirements for standard elevators for the most part in the applicable section of the ASME safety code. But they are allowed to have smaller car sizes and can have alternate door types. In other words, they may have a door that is a swing door, not a vertical sliding door, I mean a horizontal sliding door like a full passenger elevator. It still has to be powered and the operation has to be automatic, but it is allowed to do certain things. The door must be positioned on the narrow wall of the LULA car. That is a requirement of the standard and the ASME, as I recall. And they are, like I say, they're less complex than a standard elevator, but more sophisticated than a platform lift. Slide 38. Private residence elevators, as I said, are permitted only to be used within residential dwelling units. In other words, a multi-story residential dwelling unit. Not for the facility. In other words, the main elevator that gets you to the different apartments is still required to be, for the most part, a full-blown passenger elevator. But within the dwelling unit, you're allowed to use a private residence elevator. The private residence elevator is similar to an enclosed platform lift, but has some more specific door and control requirements. And it must be provided with some form of emergency communication. Usually the local code in the area requires that to be a telephone that you can call for help if you get stuck. Slide 39, okay. Platform lifts. Platform lifts can be either a vertical platform lift going straight up or down, or they can be inclined, and usually those are utilizing a stairway as part of their route to go from one floor to another. They can be exposed, in other words, open, except for no covering overhead or not in the shaft, or they can be enclosed in the shaft similar to a private residence elevator. They must have a platform with a minimum size of 30 by 48 inches to accommodate wheel mobility aids, and sometimes depending on the type of platform lift and how you get in, get out, it may be required to be larger because you're dealing with what is primarily an alcove condition. The thing you cannot use is a lift that utilizes a chair instead of a platform. These are not permitted. Those are called chair lifts, and those are not allowed by the standard, even though they are one of the things that are governed by the ASME code. Slide 40. So let me talk briefly about platform lifts, section 4.10. Again, this is just a quick diagram of an enclosed platform lift that goes from one story to another. Slide 41. Vertical platform lift, the one that goes straight up and down, there's a maximum travel distance of 12 feet, I believe. That may have changed in the later ASME standards, but the ones we reference in the ADAG and ADA and ABA is 12 feet maximum. You have a 18 square feet maximum platform floor area that the ASME specifies. A solid enclosure for the lowest level to be 42 inches above the uppermost landing. And the area under the platform has to be fully enclosed. In other words, you can't have any working parts that some child can come in and get their head stuck in and hurt and injured and otherwise messing up his entire day. Slide 42. In-kind platform lifts, again, these are ones that usually go upstairs. There is no maximum travel distance in the foot. You can start at the bottom of a 10-foot, 10-story building and go up the stairwell if you want. I probably wouldn't recommend it, but you can do that. Again, there's a 12 square foot maximum platform floor area. You have to maintain your minimum egress width. If you're putting it on a stair that's part of a means of egress. In other words, the stairway width has a certain width requirement by the fire code or the life safety code, and that has to be, you can't violate that with an incline platform lift. Because as I understand it, the safety code assumes that the incline lift is deployed, in use, and halfway up the stairs when the power goes out. And so you may be stuck on that lift, or the lift may be stuck in that position, but you still have to have enough egress width to get around it and have the firefighters and everybody who's exiting the building go up and down those stairs and not block that egress lift. And again, platform enclosure for passenger restraining arms are required for these inclined lifts. Slide 43. Now, there are times when the International Building Code and their means of egress section, section 1007, allows a platform lift to be used as part of an accessible means of egress. But if they are allowed to be used as part of a means of egress, they must have standby power as specified by the IVC. Slide 44. For general platform lifts themselves, the controls must meet the operable parts requirement, including reach ranges. Doors and gates must be power operated and meet the requirement for low energy doors, including the reference to the ASME Builders and Hardware Manufacturers Association standard in section 404.3. And must remain open for at least 20 seconds. Now, there's an exception that says if it's a straight through one floor, you get on, and you go straight through. I think this is allowed to be manually operated. I have to go check that. I think that's correct. Again, the platforms must meet the clear floor space in 305 at a minimum. And again, you would be looking at issues of alcoves depending on how you got into the space and all that kind of good stuff. And the openings and the changes in the level have to meet sections 203 and 303. Slide 45. This is your standard configuration of a platform lift in section 410 with a 36 inch minimum width, a 48 inches minimum depth, and a door that has a 32-inch minimum clear opening. Now, this could be if it's a straight on and you had to back off, this is where you would have to have a power-operated door, as opposed to if you had a straight on and straight off, in other words, you went on one side and came off the other, that might be this is an exception that you can use for that. Slide 46. One of the new things that we sort of put in here is allowing a side entry door. If you use a side entry door, in other words, the door's in the long side, two things have to happen. Number one, the door has to have a minimum clear opening of 42 inches instead of 32. The elevator just went from 48 inches minimum in length to 60 inches minimum in length, because now you're basically talking about getting into an alcove position and doing a parallel parking space. And the minimum width goes to 36 inches. Again, this is to make sure you can get in and off of it correctly. So with that, we're going to go to slide 47. And I'm going to turn it over to Brian. Take it away.
thanks, Jim. First of all, I wanted to thank everyone for joining us. I was pleasantly surprised to see that we have over 300 people on the line right now. It's encouraging to know that many people are interested in accessibility in elevators and platform lifts. Before I get started, just a quick commercial for NEI. NEI is the National Elevator Industry Incorporated, and we're the U.S. Trade Association for major elevator and escalator manufacturers. So Otis Elevator Company, Schindler Elevator Corporation, ThyssenKrupp, Fujitec, Kone, and Mitsubishi are our primary members of our association. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of what our bias is, if you will, on this. I would encourage anyone that has additional questions after the seminar today to contact us. You can go to www.nei.org. And if you go to About NEI, there's a drop-down contact information, and you can either call or send us an email if you have additional questions. I'm proud to say, because my background is in accessibility, that the national elevator industry has been one of the leaders in accessibility for its type of equipment. We had our own accessibility guidelines for elevators back in the early 70s, before the ADA was ever in place. So who is the American Society of Mechanical Engineers? It's an association that is a codes and standards development association located out of New York City that does a wide variety of different codes and standards. They deal with nuclear engineering standards, boiler codes, and then obviously elevator and escalator code and standard for platform lifts and stairway chair lifts. Slide 48. Thank you, Peggy. As regards the elevator safety code, our first American Society for Mechanical Engineers first published the code back in 1921, so it's been around for quite a long time. 2010 is our most current edition right now. We're expecting publication of the 2013 edition later on this year. It's on a three-year cycle. It used to be updated once every year, but now it's on a three-year cycle since 2010. And I note, as Jim did, that the ADA standards reference either the 1999 or the 2000 elevator safety code for the purposes of complying with the ADA. I should note that virtually all the states in the U.S. have elevator laws or building codes that reference newer editions of the A17.1. As a matter of fact, Connecticut is the only jurisdiction that references an older one. They reference the 1996 edition. So chances are you've got, setting aside the ADA issues, you have a chief elevator inspector or a building official in 49 of the 50 states that is, in fact, enforcing a newer edition of the elevator safety code than that which is referenced in the ADA standards. I don't think that that's a problem. I think that the increased level of safety in the newer editions of the code is better, and certainly there's no reduction in accessibility because the safety code does not address accessibility. Slide 49. We became a binational code in 2007. We're now tied in with the Canadian Standards Association. And it's important to note that the A17.1B44 is not an accessibility code. It, in fact, is a safety code. So we make a concerted effort to steer clear of any type of accessibility requirements because we feel that that's not our forte. We rely on both the Federal Access Board for the U.S. and also the A117.1 Accessibility Committee in the U.S. to deal with the accessibility issues. There are a couple of bleed overs. For instance, the Braille requirements and the raised numbers and letter requirements that Jim talked about previously on the elevator car operating panel inside, we replicate that requirement in the A17.1. So, but there's no conflict between the two. There is a special section within the binational code that does have accessibility standards for elevators. However, that's only applicable in jurisdictions in Canada, so it's not a U.S. concern. Slide 50. So you understand the process. The A17B44 committee is a consensus committee. It works under the ANSI consensus procedures, which means that the committee is constituted of a balance of different interests. It includes both users and building owners, enforcement authorities like chief elevator inspectors, and manufacturers such as the National Elevator Industry folks, and then a variety of other smaller manufacturers that deal with elevator and escalator products. We meet about three times a year, both in the U.S. and Canada. There are 29 separate working committees, subcommittees of the main committee that deal with everything from emergency operations to hoistway or shaft design. In addition to the A17.1 elevator safety code, there are six additional standards or guidelines or codes that it is in the family of A17 that deal with other aspects of elevator safety. The documents, unlike things like the International Building Code or the A117 Accessibility Standard, or certainly the ADA, which is kind of a cycle, if you will, the IBC, for instance, is updated every 3 years through a series of hearings. The A17 documents are continually updated through using both inquiries that are submitted to the committee and then technical revisions that are developed to respond to those inquiries so that there's never any stopping point for updating the code. Essentially, we get to a point where ASME says, okay, if you haven't made a change as of December 1st of this year, it's not going in this edition of the code, it's going to have to go to the next edition. So we don't have a cycle per se, we have a continual ongoing change of the code. Slide 51. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the myths and facts dealing that I've seen both in my work as a representative for the elevator industry and then prior to that as a building code person for a disability organization. And some of the problems that I see or the misconceptions that I see out there. Starting with slide 52, Jim showed us the different configurations for new elevator sizes. And you'll note that except for the one that had a 60x60 clearance inside, all of the other ones are such that you cannot accomplish a wheelchair chair turning space or a turning space inside the car once the doors are closed. So I don't see this as much of a mistake nowadays, but it used to be that people thought, oh, I've got to be able to close the door and get a 60-inch turning space inside the car, and that's not true. In fact, the turning space is accomplished when the door is open, so you're in fact using the landing on the floor adjacent to the elevator opening to accomplish what's a three-point turn. The main reason for that is, quite frankly, one of economics. When you start increasing the floor size of an elevator car, you significantly increase the cost of the car and the elevator system. In addition to that, you add to the cost of the entire building structure because you've got heavier elevators, which means heavier railings, which means stronger structure has to be built from floor to rooftop in order to accommodate that additional weight. So elevators are unique in that regard, in that it's one instance in where the economics of providing access comes into play in terms of saying you have to automatically have a large car size. One thing I would note, and this is a mistake I've seen sometimes with places like independent living centers that have accessibility people on staff, in virtually no case can you go into an existing building and look at an existing elevator and say, well, here's the ADA guidelines and you're missing 2 inches depth or 2 inches width. The answer is to enlarge your car. It's almost impossible in most circumstances to enlarge a car. It would be prohibitively expensive. So when you're looking at accessibility in existing buildings, especially with an elevator that was installed in the 60s or 70s, I think that it's incumbent upon the person looking at it that you have to do a fairly thorough analysis to determine whether the elevator is in fact usable for someone in a wheelchair or not. And oftentimes that relies not so much on the car size, but the position of the elevator doors in relation to the interior of the car. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and again, enlarging the car size is not an option. The 53. This is one that's interestingly come up just recently in a number of instances, and I'm not sure where it's coming from, but you'll note, and again, Jim mentioned the fact that there is that table of different braille and raised lettering and the like that has to go in, and the bells and the X's and all of that, the phone that goes next to the buttons on a car operating panel. Some people seem to think that the ADA guidelines or the E117 accessibility standard, by showing that picture, in fact, are requiring all of those buttons to be in an elevator car, and that's not the case. It's the same thing generally with the ADA, is that the general rule is you make it accessible if you're providing it. But if you're not providing it, you don't have to worry about accessibility. And the emergency stop switch is one that we've had just recently come up in a number of jurisdictions, and they're wondering why there's not an emergency stop there. In fact, the emergency stop switch was deleted by the A17 committee. A number of additions ago, it's no longer permitted in a passenger elevator. It's allowed only in freight elevators. I think the reason why we keep all of those in the ADA guidelines and the A117 standard is, as Jim noted, you're dealing with alterations in addition to new construction. You might find an emergency stop button in a 1970s passenger elevator. If you're going to lower that control panel and provide Braille and raised lettering to make it accessible to people with disabilities, you don't have to remove that stop switch at that point. So we keep that stuff in the standard to make sure that if it's there, it will in fact be accessible. Slide 54. Jim talked about door opening, and there's actually a formula in the ADA standards that stipulates that when you've got a further distance from the hall call button to the furthest elevator door, that you have to extend the amount of time that the door remains open. However, one misconception we will see, and I hate to say it, but it's from the Department of Justice. They were citing people, and I learned this as when I was working for the Eastern Paralyzed Veterans. They were citing building owners for having doors that would not remain open a full 20 seconds. When in fact what the requirement is that the door reopening device has to remain active for 20 seconds, but the door itself can start closing as quickly as 3 seconds after it's been fully opened. In that instance, between the 30 seconds and the 3 seconds and the 20 seconds, if you stick your hand in, which I don't encourage you to do, but if you break the opening, if you break the plane, the door is required to reopen. After 20 seconds, that door can start to close on its own. So for those of you who like to hold your elevator car for your friend that's running down the hallway to catch the elevator, after 20 seconds, that elevator door gets to close after all, just so the people can't keep the door open indefinitely. 55 slide. Handrails. There are no national requirements for handrails in elevator cars. In fact, they are referred to as support rails in the A17 code to make the distinction between what you oftentimes will see in an elevator and a true handrail. The reason is that handrails, if you look at the design requirements for handrails, both in A117 and the ADA, they're based on research for people who are either ambulatory, moving upstairs, or persons who are in wheelchairs or walking up a ramp. And when you're mobile, you need a certain amount of gripping and certain dimensions are required to help you as you're moving through space. Because you're not moving around once you're inside the elevator car, the A17 and the Access Board and the A117 Committee don't feel that it's essential to have handrails within elevator cars. The one exception to that is shipboard elevators, which I guess if you're on rough seas, you want to have something to grab hold of. But again, these are called support rails, and they're not regulated by the accessibility standards in the U.S. There are one or two jurisdictions, the state of Illinois, for instance, that does have a requirement for handrails in their accessibility requirements, but there are no national requirements for handrails and elevators. Slide 56. Again, A17.1 is a safety code for elevators and escalators, and covers a wide variety of different things in terms of design of the elevators, the capacity for elevators, the speed of elevators, types of different suspension beams that are in place in elevators, travel distances for elevators, and they principally address regular passenger elevators, but they do have special subcategories in different sections for things like private residence elevators and limited use, limited application elevators, shipboard elevators, mine elevators, things like that. Next slide. One thing that's permitted by A17, but is a unique challenge, I think, for the purposes of accessibility, is something that's fairly new on the within the industry. It's called destination-oriented elevator systems or destination dispatch systems. And there are specific requirements in the ADA guidelines and A117 that address the use of destination-oriented systems. The attraction of destination systems is that they're extremely energy efficient compared to your traditional elevator systems. They're also more cost effective, not only because of the energy savings, but in some instances you can actually reduce the number of elevators in a building by using a destination system. And by reducing the number of elevators required, you increase the leasable space in a building, which is always key when designing new buildings. Destination-oriented elevators, in a nutshell, the system knows or asks someone what floor they want to go to, and then tells the person which elevator they need to get on. You need to get on elevator A or B or C. So in the picture that you see in front of you here now, this woman is using a key pass system where the security pass that she has for her office or her place of business also serves as a way of inputting where she wants to go to the elevator system. So if her office is on the fifth floor, the elevator control panel that you see there will know that she needs to go to the fifth floor, and out of the eight elevators in the building will say, at this particular point in time, elevator C is the best, is the elevator we want you to go on. Next slide. Slide 58, again, the destination choice. Traditional passenger elevators, we all know that you have an up button and a down button in most instances in the elevator lobby, and you push that, and you don't get to pick your floor until you actually get into the elevator car, at which point you've got a series of buttons that you can pick your floor from. What this does is that you enter the destination in the keypad in the lobby, and again, the previous picture showed a smart card option for a secured building, and once you actually get in the elevator, there are no floor buttons at all. So if we look at the entry pad, or entry keypad in this particular picture, you'll see that it's a 12-key mechanical keypad with a what's referred to as a function key at the bottom. And if I need to go to floor 14, I input 14, and then the keypad will then tell me that I should take elevator A. When elevator A arrives, it announces itself as well, so that both in terms of the tone, that's a distinctive tone, and also vocally, so there's actually a voice that will say car A once that car reaches the landing that you're standing at. Next slide. I know there was a question that was submitted earlier, and I think one of the greater challenges, the accessibility features of a destination-oriented system are fairly straightforward. I mean, obviously the car size is the same. The height of the button or the keypads have to be within an accessible reach range. I think that the key difference that we see between what you see in the ADA guidelines versus what you see in the A117 accessibility standard, which is referenced by the building codes in the U.S., is what's referred to as a function key. And in this particular picture, the function key is a rectangular key at the bottom of the keypad, and it's designated by the International Symbol of Accessibility. In the A117 system, and this is quite frankly the system that you'll see for destination dispatch throughout the U.S., the function key activates the audible and vocal cues for blind and visually impaired persons. The ADA guidelines, or the ADA standards, don't specifically spell out what the system is supposed to do otherwise. However, the DOJ guidance on its standards for accessible design indicates that in this type of a system, that the voice enunciators and the tonal enunciators, both at the keypad and at the elevators themselves, have to remain operable all the time that the building is open and the elevators are operating. It's my own personal opinion, and I guess the industry's position as well, that in doing so, what the ADA standards have inadvertently done is make it less accessible for blind or visually impaired people. For instance, we have 300 people on the line right now. If we were to open up the phone lines and everybody could start talking at once, no one could understand what's going on. No one could understand what the other person's saying because it would just be one big garble of noise. The same is true with destination-oriented elevator systems, is if every time someone pushes a button to go to a floor, the voice enunciator starts speaking, and 99% of the people really don't need that voice enunciator, it detracts from the 1% of people that are standing in the lobby at that point in time that in fact need that voice enunciator. The person who's blind or visually impaired and can't see the LED that says go to floor or go to elevator C wants the system to tell him that. The best way to do that is that it's only enunciating for persons who are blind or visually impaired, so that it's unique to that person's need at that point in time, as opposed to telling everyone in the entire building what elevators are arriving at one point in time. The other challenge that we're finding in terms of accessibility with destination systems is that some of the manufacturers are now going to essentially a touchpad visual screen. And what we're looking at from the industry perspective is how do we develop a workaround that so that we're not assuming that blind or visually impaired people can use a touch screen, because in my opinion it really doesn't work at all. You need some sort of a workaround with the visual touch screen so that someone who's blind or visually impaired and can't see what's being projected on the screen can still use the system, and that it's just as usable for that person as it is someone who is not low vision or blind. Just as an aside, the ATM folks about 10 years ago, actually when we were developing the first draft of the new ADA guidelines under the Federal Advisor Committee, the ATM people all wanted to have visual displays on their stuff. And they were able to figure out a fairly interesting workaround from touch screens, and I think that our industry we're certainly working on that. I'm not sure we have all the answers, but we're working on addressing that problem as well. Slide 60. Firefighter service is required on all elevators. It's been required on all elevators, even if it goes 1 foot, or if it's a freight elevator since the mid-90s, I would say. Firefighter service is, I think, misunderstood by a lot of people. The way the system works is that if a smoke detector goes off in an elevator lobby, in the hoistway or shaft, or in the machine room or machinery space, then the what it does is it quote-unquote shuts the elevators down. Shutting the elevators down is actually referred to as phase one, and what it does is in that instance where smoke is detected in one of those specific areas, it drops the elevators down to a designated floor, typically the first floor or ground floor of a building. Phase two firefighter service is used by firefighters themselves, and that allows persons to then go in and reactivate the elevators using a firefighter key, so that the traditional reason for doing that was to allow firefighters to access floors near the fire floor in typically in high-rise construction. It's critical for egress and evacuation purposes. If you look at the requirements for accessible means of egress elevators, which is in the International Building Code, and then by reference to the, it's in the ADA standards as well. It's critical for accessible means of egress elevators for a number of reasons. First of all, it ensures the safety of the passenger.
Thank you so much, Brian, and we appreciate you imparting all your knowledge and experience on this topic. We don't have much time here for questions, but I did want to have Jim respond to a number of questions that have come in regarding the use of keys for platform lifts. And so I'm going to let him take it over here.
Basically, the requirement for standards doesn't really talk about key or no key. I know that originally, when this was part of the 817, a key was actually required.
In the 817.
The A-18 broke away from the A-17 and did some of their own rulemaking. They basically changed that and took out the requirement for keys. So keys aren't required for platform lifts. You can provide them, but they're not required. What the standards require is that the platform lift be independently operated, independently used. In other words, I need to show up to be able to use that.
You're in a 20-story office building, and there's an office kitchen.
The manager has the key. You have to go find the manager. Maybe the manager's on vacation. I need to leave the key, and I'm still sitting there trying to use the lift. That would not be independent. There was one of the questions that came in, says, well, in the school system, can we assign a key to the kid with a disability? And, yeah, you could do that, but what about the parent with a disability? Who shows up on parent day and needs that lift, and there's no key. And doesn't have a disability, didn't need a key, didn't get assigned a key. So, again,
one of the things that
violates the independent use access.
Accessibility
so keys are generally something you don't recommend. Because they really sort of go against the independent use thing. One of the other quick questions that came in was,
the ADA standards have begun to reference or to
as referred
to the expertise of the oil platform organizations that are better suited because it's very special need to address a particular concern.
So
and I think that at least I can't speak to the actions of course, but certainly for the accessibility committee. I think that they've done so very judiciously. They don't just willy-nilly give over accessibility issues to another code-writing body.
It was, but only in very specific situations where you have an elevator that serves a lot of floors, more than 16. And so the panel is going to be, has to be a certain size. And
Unfortunately, time is always a factor when you try to address all these issues. I just want to remind everyone that our next session is June the 6th on accessible fire alarms. So that is open for registration. You can access that session and register on www.accessibilityonline.org. Or you can call our center, 877-232-1990, and it'll help you with the registration process as well. The session is recorded. It will be archived and posted by early next week on the same website, accessibilityonline.org. Also, if you're question is still pending or you remember one later, your local ADA center can help you with those questions as well. You can contact your ADA center at 1-800-949-4232. So with that, we'll conclude today's session. Thank you everyone. To exit, please close the exit in the upper right-hand corner. Thank you and have a good day.
On the emergency phone in car number 4 in this particular building. One of the issues that is being addressed right now by the A117 committee is there a better way of providing access to persons who are deaf or hard of hearing? And I'm not sure what the answers are to that. There are some systems that are out in places like schools for the deaf that they actually have a video stream that allows for two-way communication people between the center of the hall, the responding station and the person in the car, but we don't have anything generally that can address that for the general public at this point in time. 62. I think Jim really did a good job of addressing limited application elevators. The one thing that I would point out is that they are not restricted by the ICC and the National Building Code. So whereas if Jim talked about they're being permitted by the ADA only in those instances where a quote-unquote full passenger elevator is not required, the ICC doesn't have that same restriction. So theoretically, you could have a building owner install a limited use, limited application elevator that complies with the International Building Code and yet prohibits, it violates the requirements of the ADA. I don't see that as being a real big problem. Limited use, limited application elevators really don't have a wide use in the U.S. right now. They were in fact created back in the early 90s as a response to the misuse of private residence elevators. Churches and small municipalities and their town halls were putting in private residence elevators into their buildings to try to meet the ADA, or not the ADA, but the accessibility obligations of probably Section 504 of the Rehab Act. And that was not an appropriate use of that type of device. So limited application elevators came in as a result of that. Honestly, the only difference between this and a quote-unquote regular elevator is the car size. It's the 18 square foot maximum size is the big distinction. But it has the same rated load as a regular passenger elevator. It's got a higher rated load than a platform lift or a private residence elevator. So it's, I think, a good economical alternatives, particularly in alterations. Not so much in new construction, but for someone who wants to install vertical access, whether it's required or not, in an existing building, a LULA is a good way to go. 63. Again, residence elevators are never permitted in commercial applications. Commercial including places like churches, which are not covered by the ADA, but that was oftentimes where we saw the misapplication of private residence elevators were in churches or synagogues that were trying to become accessible. One point is that now that both the ADA and the A117 standard have developed requirements for accessible private residence elevators, they should only be applied in dwelling units that are required by either the ADA or the building code to be accessible. The intent was not to say that a private homeowner has to put in an accessible private residence elevator. It probably makes sense to do so, but they're not required in dwelling units or homes that are not required by either a state or a federal law or regulation to be accessible. And next slide, 564. Jim mentioned ASME 18.1 is the safety standard for platform lifts and the stairway chair lifts. This was broken out from the A17 elevator safety code about 10 years ago. It was actually as a part of the when we became bi-national with the Canadian standard, we had to separate out those parts of the A17 that are not covered by our Canadian counterparts. So the platform lift standard became a standalone document again in the early part of the 2000s. I was actually a charter member of the ASME 18 committee, as was Marcia Mass from the Federal Access Board, and I have to apologize because I've since left that group, and I'm not as much up to date on some of the technical criteria that have been added to A18 in the past couple of years. But I think I can cover some of the basics that are covered by that standard. Next slide. Slide 65, I'm sorry. Again, it covers platform lifts, both inclined and vertical, and stairway chair lifts, which are the type of device that Jim mentioned beforehand. Essentially a floating chair that goes up the incline of a stair. Most often used by individuals in their private homes, although they're actually allowed in commercial buildings by this particular standard. I'm not sure why someone would want to put one in because it doesn't meet any of the accessibility requirements of either the ADA or the applicable building codes. Next slide, 66. Jim mentioned some of the limitations. Now, the original, when platform lists were regulated by the 817.1, they were not permitted to penetrate floors, and they weren't allowed to go greater than 12 feet in vertical rise. The standard has expanded since that original first edition, and now they are allowed to go 14 feet as opposed to 12 feet, and are also allowed to penetrate one floor. So there may be instances in which these types of devices may serve as an accessible route in multi-story buildings, whereas under the old A17 standard or A17 code, they couldn't do it because they couldn't penetrate the floors from floor one to floor two in a two-story building. Because in private commercial facilities, the ADA does not require an elevator in a two-story building, most two-story buildings, you may see these being used in two-story buildings. Now that a floor penetration is permitted, and they can be enclosed in a hoistway as shown in the left-hand picture in this particular slide. My bias is, and my bias actually predates my work with the elevator industry, is that I would far prefer that someone who is in a wheelchair, for instance, be given an elevator in this type of circumstance. I don't think that, and the lift people would be the first to agree, that the number of safety requirements placed on a platform lift are not as great as those placed on a regular passenger elevator. And unless finances were a huge concern, I would rather see someone, regardless of disability, have the safety provisions that are afforded by a full passenger elevator as opposed to a platform lift. There are also platform lifts require constant pressure switches, for instance. So unlike an elevator with a full automatic operation where you walk into the elevator car, push the button, and the elevator takes over from there, in this particular type of device, vertical platform lift, you actually have to hold the button in place as you're ascending or descending. And if you let go of the button for whatever reason, you're stuck mid-floor. So it's not as accessible a vertical access option as a regular elevator would be. Slide 67. Jim, I think, covered inclined platform lifts fairly well. I won't bother with that because I see we're getting towards the end of our time here. There's just, if we go to slide 68. Slide 68 is what is in the future. I just want to point out one thing. As a result of almost a decade's worth of work subsequent to the World Trade Center, there are new requirements in both the A17 Elevator Safety Code and in the International Building Code for what are referred to as occupant evacuation elevators. This goes well beyond the accessible means of egress elevators that are currently permitted by both the IBC and the ADA standards. This is envisions everyone in a building in the case of a fire being able to use the elevators to evacuate the building, which is critical when you look at things like high-rise construction. If you're up 50, 60 stories, very few people can effectively use the stairs to evacuate a building, and it's very slow to evacuate. This new system, all of the passenger elevators in the building will be able to evacuate, occupants of the building, irrespective of whether they're disabled or not. And that I expect to see as a growing trend in the near future. And with that, I'm finished with my part.